Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ed McElhenney. If you were here last year, you might remember my face. I'm a year older. I've got hearing aids now, and I just replaced my right knee. So I probably won't be standing the entire show today. But it's not my show. It's this lady's show over here. You just saw the introduction. I'm honored to be here, to be the rudder that steers the ship, so to speak. And I could introduce her as, what, Lieutenant Commander Schultz. I could introduce her as Captain Schultz. But instead, I introduce her as my friend, Tammy Jo. And Tammy Jo, thank you so much for being here. And the airplanes that are here, by the way, one is obviously the F-18. This is a Growler, F-18G. And I'm going to say my thank yous right up front. These folks that are sitting here in these green suits, they came from Whidbey Island, Washington. And it's their airplane. So thank you, guys and girls, for providing that airplane. And the next two people over there, Tim and Claire Knutson, that's their N3N. And no, Tammy Jo didn't start her Navy career in the N3N. No, she didn't. But it's their airplane. And that young lady there with a microphone in her hand, she's the one who flew it in here, 21 years old, and she's been flying it for 3 years. And what it does is get it back to where we really want to talk about women in aviation, first of all. The reason we're here today, and I'll just tell you right now, that Connie and I were watching the Super Bowl this year, and I'm sure a lot of you watched the Super Bowl. And did you see the flyby? You know, we always enjoy the Star Spangled Banner and then the flyby afterwards. Anybody remember what was in the flyby? Oh, yeah. Okay. F-35 was flight lead. You had two Super Hornets on the wing, and you had a Growler in trail. Okay. I said, hey, that's pretty cool. Okay, they don't show it very long. But then they had some cockpit views. And in the cockpit views, all of a sudden I'm going, wow, that's a girl, and that's a girl, and that's a girl, and that's a girl. They were all females flying these fighters. And I'm, you know, yeah. I was at first taken aback. I'm going, come on, you know, we fly these things too. Why not at least have one guy in there? But then they brought up the fact that, hey, the reason they were doing that was because it was the 50th year that female aviators were allowed to fly Navy airplanes. So it was the 50th anniversary. And I sat there and I said, that's good. I get it. Wonderful. And then Connie and I looked at each other and said, okay, do we know any female Navy aviators? And we said, yes, we do. And so a couple phone calls, and the next thing you know, Tammy Jo says, yes, indeed. I would be pleased and happy to be part of this program. So that's how we got to where we are. So it's going to be concentrated more on female Navy aviators. And I'll just say right now, first of all, and I do this on every presentation, military veterans, active, retired, please stand. We want to say thank you. Thank you for your service. And the follow-on to that, of course, is how about female aviators? How many female aviators do we have in the audience out there today? Can we see those who please stand if you're a naval, a female aviator? Okay. We've got a few. You are in the, yes, you are. You got to be kidding me. You're in the back seat of that thing. So anyway, that's why we're here today, and Tammy Jo can help me out a little bit on this because, hey, you know, ladies flew these airplanes way back when, the Wasps, back in the 40s. And, yeah, feel free to chime in anytime, but I'll turn a little bit over to Tammy Jo right now.
Right. One of the things that I've heard this year, because it's the 50th year of celebrating 50 years of women flying in the military, the Navy was first. Sorry.
You're right. I agree.
It's the Air Force versus Navy today. But often I hear, well, but the Wasps were first. And truly, we do stand on the shoulders of the Wasp if you're a female aviator in the military because they flew military aircraft. However, they were not in the military. They bought their own uniforms. They designed, and Jacqueline Cochran made their wings. They paid board and room. They had no medical. If somebody was killed in the line of duty, which did happen, the girls pitched together to pay for either transportation of the body home or the funeral. So the military itself, those ladies wore wings of silver, and in the Navy in 1973, they opened it up for women to fly, and the wings were gold. Were open to women.
And the missions truly back then, I mean, they did ferry missions, they did test missions, they got shot at. They towed banners, you know, and if you don't know, you know, they would tow a banner for gunnery practice and stuff like that. High altitude stuff, they did a lot of dangerous stuff, yet they, again, still, hey, couldn't be in the military, and that was the way it was.
Right, and it's interesting to me because not only did they fly, which I think we owe them a solemn but happy moment of gratitude for that. But so many of them went on to do things like Betty Green, who you don't hear very often about the WASP named Betty Green. But if you're familiar with Mission Aviation Fellowship, she was their first pilot. It was her vision before she even went into the WASPs to use aviation to break that isolation of people with medical, education, and spiritual help. So that's an organization that is around the world and alive today. And whenever we talk about towing banners, one of her stories was when she towed the banner, they initially shot at her aircraft until until her male instructor got on the horn and said, "Hey, the banner." And so the mortars quit exploding by the cockpit and near the aircraft, and they started to the banner. So it was sometimes more dangerous than necessary.
So anyway, that's how it started. And then we got into 1973, and Tammy Jo sat there and said, "Hey, I want to do this." And yeah, unfortunately, the United States Air Force said no. And yeah, there's more to that story, I'm sure, also.
Right. Well, and to begin with the ladies who started in 1973, there were some, three of the ladies were already in OCS, going through officer candidate school. So they said, well, let's see if any of those ladies are interested. So Judy, Jane, and Barbara began, they finished their OCS, and then three other ladies, Mary Rosemary Mariner, who was my skipper in the Navy, and Joellen. So the first three, they gave props, and the last three, they gave helos, but Rosemary dug in her heels and said, "Nope, I came with my commercial and my college at 19, I want jets." And so that was the original six.
Wow. And Rosemary ended up being a former commander of yours, correct?
Right. She was the first woman to take command of an aviation squadron in the U.S.
Okay.
And VAQ-34, it was commissioned during Reagan's time as president. And so he was increasing the Navy not only by ships but by aircraft. And so our mission was to study Russian, Chinese, and French weapons and tactics and then employ those against the fleet. And it ran from Top Gun students, other squadrons, single ships, to entire carrier group workups.
Okay, and just to show that I've done my homework, VAQ, you'll hear her talk about VAQ. And that's what these folks are out of, too. They're out of a VAQ squadron. The V stands for fixed wing, okay?
Right.
The A stands for attack, okay? And the Q stands for electronic, okay? So they're jammers, basically. That's what this airplane is designed to do, and that's what that squadron was designed to do. It was a support squadron, if you will, but that was the VAQ. And you were a member of that squadron also.
Right. And to be honest, I don't know all of the Growler mission, but we did more than jam. We simulated. And so I think maybe do you all do simulations as well?
Yeah.
So that mission is still alive today. It just transferred from that small VAQ-33 and 34 sister squadrons to the Growler community today.
All right. How about a quick synopsis of your career? Okay, you obviously started out in the T-34 and then worked your way up.
Right. actually, I mean, just as a real quick review, for those that might be listening or younger ears that think, I don't know how to get into a cockpit. And I saw the jets overhead, our ranch there in southern New Mexico. And
I was one of them, by the way. I was a T-38. That was fighter lead-in training at Holloman, New Mexico. And believe it or not, that time frame, I was probably up there.
Right. And I'll be sending you the bill for all the broken windows later. Because it wasn't until I was in the Navy later and had done some air-to-air that I realized there really was no reason for those guys to go scorching by our ranch, breaking the sound barrier and all our windows at 500 feet or so. There's not a lot of air-to-air that happens at that altitude.
It was fun. Come on.
Mm-hmm. We know what kind of a rule breaker you are. But so seeing this air show overhead as they anchored their dogfighting practice over our hay barn, I mentioned to my folks, you know what? I think that's what I'd like to do. And my mom came back with, Tammy, though, those people are smart. She always had a wonderful, frank way about her. She still does. And so I started reading books about airplanes and pilots and read the book Jungle Pilot. Nate Saint was the pilot in that, an MAF pilot. And he'd gotten his start in the military for no money down, which was the amount I had. And so that kind of just opened the doors for me, and I could see this faint footpath emerging from barnyard to cockpit. And so that's the path I followed. And everybody shut their doors. At that time, it was 1983 by the time I got my college degree. And the Air Force said no 3 times and don't come back. And then the Army was polite, listened, and said, you are not a fit for us. So I moved on to the Navy. And truthfully, it is a good lesson, and sometimes those doors that are shut are meant to be shut, because the Navy was the only branch at that time that was allowing women to fly tactical aircraft in tactical missions, and the combat exclusion policy was solidly in place. It wasn't even being considered to be lifted, but the Navy had the attitude that if it's not combat, go for it. And so that's why I got to fly A-7s, and then Rosemary Mariner, who was in the first class and our skipper, when they started considering lifting the combat exclusion policy, sent us to A-7 weapons, 2 of us. But I started in the T-34, back to your question, I didn't forget, the T-34, and then on to the and I do have to stop and just say I arrived without hardly knowing what an aileron was. So on the first flight, my instructor, who was a Marine, absolutely, United States Marine Corps, I should say. Then he said, I'm going to demo most of this, just pay close attention. So I did. He did the departure, showed me how to maneuver within the MOA via beaches, buildings, things like that. And then he said, let's go do some touch and goes at the outlying field. Let's just do a downwind entry. And it was my first real helmet fire, because I thought, I have no idea what he's talking about. A downwind entry. I'd studied the break. I knew the break, but he was demoing. So I thought, well, I'll just write down what he does. And he rolled inverted, pulled down, rolled upright on altitude, airspeed, and the downwind. So I just drew what I thought it looked like and learned how to land and went back, did the break. The next day I said, all right, Bonnell, show me that you listened. And so we did all the things that we did the day before, and he said, all right, let's go do some touch and goes. So we're about the same place we were the day before, and I got as close as I could. I rolled inverted, pulled down. There was, well, I know Marines don't scream, but he was using his excited voice. And the beating of fists on the canopy let me know that he wasn't as buckled in for my downwind entry as I had been for his. So it was a debrief item, and I learned what the downwind entry was. But on to T2s. I recovered from that.
By the way, the T2, if you look over our shoulder here to the left, there's a T2 Buckeye right there. That's what she's about to talk about.
Right. That it has the the name the guppy by those who fly it, just because it looks like that fierce little fish. But it is a sturdy jet, you know, straight wing, tip tank, so it's very, very stable. But it was our first jet to bring aboard the boat. This was pre-Top Gun 1, so we didn't have all the film footage of the carrier deck or the Kenny Loggins music to inspire us as we went out. And we're trying to sneak a peek at the carrier, at the Lexington, as we're in four-plane formation, threatened with death if we made the airplane, you know, the formation look bad. So that was certainly fun. They send you out there, and I'm sure it's probably the same, but every stage of flight that we had learned so far, we always had an instructor. And then you go to do your carrier landings, you practice on the field, but the first time you go see the boat, you're solo. And every time as a student, they told us they couldn't pay anybody enough to get in their backseat. But they had figured out that they need your decision loop very tight around the carrier. It's a dynamic area. They don't need you thinking about what your instructor is thinking about what you should do. They just need you thinking about what you should do. And my first launch, they had told us, okay, don't show us the planned form of your T2. You know, rise slowly and don't stall out. And so, especially being the only girl in my squadron, which happened the first four squadrons, I was the only female there. So I was determined. I was not going to look like a sissy. So as I got shot off, I just kept going 60 feet above the water. Finally, they said, Bonnell, pull up. And when I got back, my instructor had written in the book, check intake for mackerel. So on to the A4. And we don't have an A4 here, but I bet there's one on the line someplace. It's anybody who's flown the A4 loves it. It was light attack, pulled back from the fleet for training, and so we traded in the stable wings and tip tanks for the very delta wings and the maneuverability to do all the fleet exercises that we would plan to see in the future, low levels, bombing, strafing, air-to-air, and more carrier. Oh, and then A7, I talked a little bit about that.
But before, A7 was operational. I mean, that was when you were in VA.
Right.
But before that, didn't you do the T2 as a, we used to call them FAPES. So was it as a SIRGRAD? Was that
right.
What you were?
In okay. I have to say, the Navy made it a good deal. I don't know that the Air Force still has come around to that. But the Navy being a SIRGRAD, whenever you got your wings, then you had to have a good grade average, and the skipper has to ask for you. And so I had a great skipper, Commander Grant, in T2s, and I went back to instruct for him. He was even more fun to instruct for than to be a student in his squadron. And I instructed in T2s. Had a change of command.
Before you go there, you instructed in the T2. Isn't one of your students in the T2 here too?
I don't know.
Okay.
Oh, yes. I suppose he is. Right there.
Where's Dean? Oh, yeah. By the way, that's Dean. That's Tammy Jo's husband. And I found this out today that Dean was one of Tammy Jo's students in the T2 Buckeyes.
I'm not going to leave it there, Ed. I have to tell you, I wasn't his instructor, and he called saying he couldn't find a cross-country instructor, and he needed one. So I said, well,
for him.
Right. There were three other there was a total of four airplanes going the night before. Everybody else canceled. And I've always been suspicious of that. But
well done, Dean. Well done. That's all I can say.
And he was charming, but I thought, you know what? I'm grading him. He needs to be charming. But he has been charming for the last 35 years.
All right. Sorry to interrupt. You can continue your story now. But, yeah, Dean Schultz is – go ahead. Dean, stand up. Wave at everybody. That's another Southwest guy, another Hornet guy. Another veteran. So – thanks for being here.
So I did instruct for a couple of years. I had a change of command in the middle of that. I had gotten my advanced quals as an instructor, teaching carrier landings, and then I had just finishing up my guns qual. And the new skipper said, oh, no, I will not have a woman teaching weapons in my squadron. So I got pulled from that and sent to teach out of control flight. And
while, in the T2. This is in the T2.
In the T2, yes. And while it was not my choice, and rather punitively assigned, it turned out to be some of the best training that I ever had. It's true, you don't know a subject till you teach it. And we had more than spins. One day you had asked me about, one day we had an asymmetrical transfer of fuel in our tip tank, and they were old enough at the time that the float valve that you can see, the plexiglass was so clouded, we really couldn't see the ball very well. So in flight, we didn't realize that when we did our first stall, we had one empty tip tank and one full. So that made for not a spin, but a spiral. And at that time, the T2 Buckeye didn't have spiral recovery technique in the NATOPS. They'd done it at test pilot school by just seeing how can we make this thing spiral. But we didn't have any procedures to get out. And so my student, it was supposed to be just a stall, and then it whips around. And if you're not familiar, a spin is kind of a maple leaf going around sideways, flat at about 90 knots, oscillating. But a spiral is a drill bit, and it gets faster and faster. And the student, I took the controls. Usually I waited till 18,000 feet, starting at 30. But this one I just took immediately. And he started with 28, 27, 26, 27. And by the time we were at 10, it was just a squeak. And but we did. I was getting married in just a couple of months, and I remember thinking, you know, adrenaline gives you that slow down of time just because it accelerates your thought process. And I just remember thinking, I will be a Godzilla bride. This is going to be awful. Because ejecting is kind of a messy, bruisey situation. And so I tried all the different combinations I could think of. And at 5,000 feet, we wobbled into control and pulled out. And
wow.
I was afraid he wouldn't go back and do the flight again, the student, because it was not an enjoyable ride. So we went up and finished the flight. And he kissed the ground when we got back, unashamedly.
Wow. Yeah. I've been out of control several times. Our out of control altitude was 10,000 feet. If you're out of control passing 10,000 feet, you're out of there. And the fact that you stayed with it as long as you did, yeah, and figured out how to, hey, make that thing recover. And I guess it was after the fact, you know, when you said, hey, the airplane did this, we don't know why. And that's when they figured out, oh, by the way, you know, there was a transfer problem. And yeah, that's what made it do what it did.
Right. It was kind of funny to me. It was kind of funny in that we went back and said, we had a spiral. And the skipper said, no, you didn't. And I said, no, we really, and we described it. And he turns to my student. He goes, did you really have a spiral? And so we called TPS and found out, you know, what were the procedures to get out of it, which I memorized.
Uh-huh. How about transitioning to the F-18? Was that a pretty big transition?
You know, it was interesting because I think Rosemary, Captain Mariner, sending Pam Lyons and I ahead to do the A-7 weapons training with the fleet-bound pilots before the combat exclusion policy was lifted. You know, operating an aircraft in its most dynamic performance arena really helps prepare you for anything. It broadens your aviation base. So going to the Hornet was a big jump in responsiveness as well as mission, because A-7s, you know, a face only a mother could love, but great low-level aircraft, great attack. It had more, carried more Mike than the Hornet, and things like that, but the responsiveness and being able to do more air-to-air came along with going to the Hornet. And Pam and I were the first to go through the RAG. It hadn't been open to women before, and there were some really great attitudes to meet us, and there were some really not great attitudes to meet us. And it's really always made me come away from that whole idea of transparency with a new perspective. I think it's a little like yoga pants, not for everybody.
How about, I got to ask the question, when I transitioned to the F-16, they made all of our, in instructors at that point go down to the spin dryer, the centrifuge.
Right.
Was that a requirement for you guys and girls, you know, when you went through the F-18 school?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes, and we've hopefully taken any of those images out of the public domain.
I know. It's not pretty. I've got one, too. But we did have some people who really struggled, and I got to say, from a personal standpoint, we put the first female F-16 pilot through our guard school in Wichita. Jackie Parker was her name, and she wasn't a big girl. But she had a few issues with G loadings, you know. I mean, she wasn't the best, she wasn't the worst, but she learned to cope, you know. I mean, we all had G suits and stuff like that. But you know, for our F-16, it was a 9G airplane. The Hornet's what, a 7.3? I can't remember somewhere.
I think 7.8.
Okay, 7.8. Okay, but still, that's a lot of G's, you know. And yeah, and she, like I said, you know, she graduated and did fine. But I was just wondering, you know, in air-to-air combat, was ever a factor for you?
You know, it wasn't, but it's kind of, to me, I think it's a little like air sickness. Some people have a tendency for it. Some people don't. Some people have an affinity for withstanding Gs. Some don't. I don't think it's a male-female issue. I think it's person-to-person. We did find that, like, after a break, after we'd gone on leave or Christmas, and we get in, we wouldn't go right to 7 again. Yeah. You know, you give yourself a flight or two to get, I'd say, G buffed up for it, and then you're on.
I was the same way. You know, I was flying for the airlines at the time, and if I had an international flight, you know, and it was a three-day trip, hey, that next day after I got home, I wouldn't fly a high G flight. I mean, yeah, it was right. Like, hey, at least take a day off, and yeah. All right, so we've gone from the T-34 to the T-2 to the A-7 to the F-18, and now I got to say, since we're getting close on time, let's go to the Southwest thing. Got hired by Southwest, and away you went. Easy, hard, did they accept you right away? Of course, we've got, where's Connie back there? Yeah, if you didn't know, Connie, let's see, third female hired by Delta Airlines in 1978. It was probably a little easier for you, but was there difficulty in getting hired as a female by Southwest?
You know, I don't know that the difficulty was really in getting hired. It was surviving sometimes.
Okay.
But I have to mention the good guys, because there were always good guys. I feel like God always provided people like Jerry Bradley, who's in the crew here, and Jim Rice, who I believe is here as well. And so I always had some incredible men as mentors and leaders. And it was a turbulent time, I would say, just because nobody deals with change well. We all have something about the way things used to be that we liked. So there was a big change. Aviation is a tight community. Women going into combat didn't set well, even in a commercial cockpit. With some folks, even though I don't rule Congress, I had nothing to do with it, you know, that was something I heard a lot about. Then there was crew resource management that had come on the scene, and that meant we were going to utilize both pilots in the cockpit. There was no more sky gods. Captains now had a Magna Carta. They had to, you know, be a team player. And so there were some that had grown up in the idea of, I am finally a sky god and I'm holding on to it, that it was a little difficult. But those things, you know, time marches on, and I think everybody learned.
How about becoming a captain? How long were you first officer before you turned into a captain?
I was the first officer for 5 years. I had our second baby, took some extra time off with the Marshal, and then went back and was a captain for 20.
Okay. And I got to bring up the fact that Marshal is their son. He can't be here today. You knew this was coming, okay? You started it with the Air Force Navy thing. So
it's
anyway,
fine.
Their son graduated from the United States Air Force Academy last year, okay?
We asked him, Dean and I are both Navy pilots. We said, Marshall, is this how a good son rebels? He said, I'm bringing honor back to the family name.
And oh, by the way, one of the Growler girls over there is a United States Naval Academy graduate, by the way.
Thank you.
So she's
nice to be represented.
And yeah, Marshall's right now, what, T6 school, flying formation?
T6, learning to fly close
in Oklahoma.
To other people.
Yep. All right, so now we're into the Southwest side of things a little bit, and Boy, I don't want to go through the whole story, and I will just compliment you on your actions, your crew's actions, I should say, because as well we know, it's not just Tammy Jo that did it. It's Tammy Jo, it's the first officer, it's the flight attendants in the back who helped out, and yeah, launched out of LaGuardia, headed to Dallas, as I remember, and you know, all of a sudden, you know, bang. And I can sit there, you know, as a former airline guy, I don't know how many times I was in simulator training, you know, the instructor goes, boom, you know, he hits the side of the simulator, you know, an engine rolls back. Hey, you hear a hissing sound, you know, hey, O2 mask, got, you know, and you do the what do they call it, immediate action items and all that kind of stuff. But that's what she was trained to do. And she did it extremely, extremely well. And I compliment you on that. And yeah, I'll turn it over and just say, hey, things that you want to bring out to the crowd that you think is important.
Sure. Well, as Ed said, aviation, no matter how many seats in the airplane, is never a solo sport. And I had incredible crew. Darren Elliser was my first officer. My flight attendants were Rachel Fernheimer, Catherine Sandoval, and Shanique Mallory. And I say their names slowly because it's important. They were a huge part of the success of that day. And we were headed from New York to Dallas, full of passengers, even one on the jump seat, and then heavy with fuel, about 33,000 feet. We heard that bang, but instead of the bang and the engine rolling back, we heard the bang, the engine roll back, did a snap, roll, pitch over, and skidded. And so the bang turned into a shudder and a roar rather than calming down, and we got control of the aircraft and tried to slow down some of the shuddering by just slowing the aircraft down. The shuddering that came on was enough that we couldn't focus our eyes on instruments or checklists, and then there was smoke that had been pulled into the cockpit from the explosion, and then a condensation cloud from the rapid depressurization. Since we were close to 33,000 feet, and the shuddering, we found out later, came from the damage, the engine, whenever the number 13 blade had severed near the hub and the dovetail, it had helixed forward and created a sonic boom inside of the engine, which that's actually what did the damage, not the blade itself. But that kind of peeled the engine cowling back like banana peel, and the small pieces tore chunks out of the leading edge of the wing and different parts of the fuselage and the tail. One rather large chunk, one of the buckles from underneath the cowling, struck right in front of the 14th row window. And so that's what took out that window. And the shuddering from all the damage, which never really got into a syncopation. I mean, there was always a different feel and tear and sound, which I think was really disconcerting for those in the back as well, who were closer to the sound, I think. And then the rapid depressurization. I know it's a mouthful, but everybody has seen one. If you see a balloon pop, you've seen a rapid depressurization, and it's air equalizing pressure, and it does so rapidly and with force. We were at 33,000 feet equalizing our cabin pressure, which was at 7,000 at that point. 70 degrees inside the cabin, negative 25 outside. And then the roar that came along that never went away, that grew, and it just got to a certain decimal, and it just stopped because there was no more available. And it smothered every sound in a way that Darren and I, we only sit a foot and a half apart, but we couldn't even hear our own voice over it. And so that, of course, is caused by all the wind coming in that one window. When you go down the road at 60 miles an hour, you know how disconcerting that one window down can be, not just from the sound, but also from the reverberation of 60 mile an hour wind trying to get out of that window that it's also coming in. And we were 550 miles an hour plus whenever this happened. So there was just a lot of dynamic air temperature, pressure, things going on. And Darren and I think we both kind of had a moment of isolated, adrenaline-filled time there when you can't really see anything or communicate, and you have a stabbing pain in your ears as your eustachian tubes collapse, and then realizing you're not breathing very well. And after we got it back in, we got our oxygen masks on. We did it one at a time because at that point we needed both feet, both hands, and full attention.
I was going to say, the first rule in aviation is maintain aircraft control.
Maintain aircraft control.
And that's what they did very well.
And then analyze the problem, take appropriate action, and then maintain situational awareness. So we kept control of the aircraft. The first problem was we needed oxygen. So we took care of that one at a time, and then figured out where we needed to go. Long runway, medical, within decent distance, which was Philadelphia. And
I like your radio calls too. I mean, it's just like calm as you could possibly be. I'm just going, you got to be kidding me. You know, I think my voice would go up real high, but no, she'd say, you know, mayday, mayday, mayday. Hey, you know, we got an engine. I think the words you used were, we have an engine fire, and then you said you were losing some parts, I think, and
it was probably the fourth time that they asked me if I was declaring an emergency that I said, yes, we have parts missing and someone went out. Because at that point, we didn't know all that had happened. We did know that there was a window out and that that we needed to slow down for gentlemen who are helping. And I have to take a moment. Anytime I speak about Flight 1380, I do want to highlight some passengers that got up and truly, along with the flight attendants, changed the ending of the day for those people. And that is Tim McGinty, Andrew Needham, and 78-year-old Peggy Phillips, who got up during this flight that was very rough and did CPR on Jennifer Reardon, our passenger that we were not able to return to her family.
Wow. Well, I again, in the name of time, I've got to compliment you on hey, yes, you had good training. You did exactly what you were trained to do, and I say that for the airline pilots that are out there. You know, again, you know, that's our job. You know, our job is to handle situations just like that, and you made it look, you know, I won't say routine, but hey, you did all the right things at the right time. Fortunately, unfortunately, there was one passenger lost, but it could have been, you know, so much worse, so well done. Hopefully there will never be another situation like that again. And if so, I hope somebody like you is in the cockpit to do it. So I compliment you.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to go over, I can tell that already, but we're going to do a quick walk around of the aircraft. I'm going to start first with the N3N, and Claire is going to come up over here and talk a little bit. This is the 21-year-old who's, flew it in here. She's been flying it for 3 years. Her dad is the owner of the airplane over there, too, and I'm hoping that she may turn into a future Air Force aviator, but I don't know. We'll or Navy, it's okay. But
we'll see.
But experienced pilot, started flying in J3s, and go ahead. And where'd you go from there? J3s, and then.
Yeah, absolutely. So I started in a J3 Cub when I was probably 13. I remember my first flight lesson with my dad. We have a airstrip in northern Wisconsin, a grass strip, 2,000 feet, and so. Remember the first day I was taxiing, and 13 years old, I didn't really know how to move my feet quite correctly, and I thought I was going to go in the hay field, and he said, no, just keep going, you're not going to go in. So that was my first memory of taxiing the J3 Club, and of course, you know, now taxiing this thing is a beast, but that definitely prepared me. So yeah, I started at 13 probably, I mean, not officially, but, and then at 15, I decided to take a little break. My brother passed away in an aircraft accident, and so I just wasn't quite into the aviation at that point, but maybe around 16 or 17, I just knew that he absolutely loved aviation, and I wanted to continue that passion in my family and be the next generation of pilot. So at 17, on the morning of my junior prom, I soloed our family 150, and then about a year later in 2020, COVID hit, school shut down, but of course, aviation didn't shut down. You know, flying a 150 around alone in the air was the perfect way to spend COVID. So 2020, I got my private pilot's license, and I went off to UW-Madison. And then on winter breaks, I would normally work on my writtens. And then in the summer, I did my instrument rating. The following summer, I did my commercial rating. And then this past January, I got my commercial multi-engine rating. And now here we are. And so I guess when I was 19, I was able to take the N3N around the patch for the first time alone. And that was super exciting. And now I've just kind of, in the summers when I'm home, I absolutely loved to fly it with my dad. And flying it in this year was incredible. And the Fisk arrival and landing it right on the green dot was just something that I've dreamed of my entire life. So it was great to be able to experience that. And now being here surrounded by, you know, these amazing women in aviation is just a great experience. So I'm so happy to be here, and thank you so much for having us and the N3N on display.
How about the history? How long have you had the N3N?
So I believe my dad and his sister, Heidi, went to pick it up in Florida when he was maybe 21 and she was 16, and they flew it from Florida to Wisconsin in 1990. So we've had it in the family for a little over probably 30 years.
Wow.
So yeah, I've grown up with it, and I've never really truly understood the history until we've kind of been preparing for this and, you know, knowing all the different naval aviators that had trained in this, and it was on floats. The Naval Academy is just, you know, incredible to be able to fly this piece to history. And if only an airplane could talk, that'd be incredible to hear the stories that it's...
How about some differences? You know, everybody looks at it and says, oh, it looks like a Stearman.
Right, exactly. So I think some of the main differences are that it has four ailerons, and then it's also a little bit heavier than a Stearman, and then the landing gear is completely different. I think the rudder also is different, and then I think the main part is that it's all aluminum, and so I believe that Stearman have some, like, piping, and so that there can lead to some corrosion in there that you just wouldn't know about. So the nice thing about the N3N is that you can see everything, and so if there's any corrosion or anything happening with that, you can, you know, be sure to tackle that right away, and there's no surprises for you. I think those are the main ones. Oh, we also have removable wingtips. So it was a World War II trainer, so I think a lot of the cadets would ground loop it, and so they could just run out, switch the wingtips, and keep on moving. So,
yeah. But you've never done that.
Nope. Don't plan on it either.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for allowing us to have the beautiful airplane here. Congratulations on flying it in, too. Good luck flying it out.
That's always
exciting also.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to stop there again. I know we're running out of time, but I'm going to talk to the Growler guys for a minute and just say, yep. All right. Shelby.
Yes. Hello.
United States Naval Academy 2014. Okay.
The red one. Sounds good.
And Whidbey Island, and I'll stop there and just give us a little history of the airplane and how long you've been there, et cetera. We're going to get Tammy Jo to come up, and maybe the two of you could, like, maybe just walk around and tell some differences. This is a Super Hornet that's been modified to be a Growler. And if y'all didn't know, you know, a Growler, it basically replaced the EA-6B, correct?
Yes, okay. That's correct.
EA-6B was a jammer. I flew with them many times. Standoff jammer, in close, whatever you want to do. The problem with the EA-6B was it was big, it was slow. Hey, they couldn't go in with you. Well, guess what? These folks can go in with you, and you desperately need them if you're going in today's war. With all the electronics that are out there, hey, you want these guys. The beeps and squeaks is what we were talking about. So, go ahead and tell us a little bit about the airplane and where you guys are from.
Yes, sir. Yeah, so we're from Whidbey Island, Washington, where most of our Growler squadrons are located. BAQ-129 is the fleet replacement squadron, so we are in charge of instructing the next generation up in this aircraft. So our main focus for this aircraft is detection and suppression of enemy radiation, and enemy employers. So we're mostly focusing on an air-to-ground mission, and we're supporting entities that need to get in close to take out those targets or get into an area. We're out there kind of suppressing anything that would detect them or cause them harm.
And you're an EWO, correct?
Yes, sir.
Electronic Warfare Officer. So she sits in the back there, and got all the stuff, okay? The guy up front does the pilot stuff, okay? And, hey, she's the one who's sitting there, and, hey, she can tell when she gets lit up by, you know, a variety of systems, and, hey, she can shut them down. And they don't have any of the pods. Typically, you know, a mission with this airplane, how many pods do you have on board the airplane?
Yeah, we can usually take up to 3 pods as a standard loadout, and we fly usually in a section of growlers so that we can offer suppression from different angles.
Okay. Yes, sir. And I'll ask Tammy Jo, okay, difference between what you flew and this thing right now, Super Hornet versus the normal Hornet that you flew.
Well, for one thing, it's bigger, square intakes, and I don't know that the pylons are any different. Are they different?
They're slightly canted, but not so different, yes.
Okay, and we would often carry the 500-pound fuel tanks on either side with then a tack or a pod. We did a lot of missile simulation. I don't know if you do that, but silkworm missiles were a big simulation that we did for ships.
Okay, we still do carry simulated missiles, and we are able to carry air-to-ground and air-to-air weaponry on board. And in a full battle growler configuration, we'll usually have 2 pods on each wing and 1 in the center line, and then the fuel tanks on the wings as well with our able to employ off the wingtips for air-to-ground and air-to-air. So it's a very heavy aircraft once we get fully loaded up. So it's definitely a fun challenge for our pilots.
Okay. I'm going to say it's 11 o'clock. They're going to start giving me the hook here right now. I'll say thank you for right now, but we're going to open it up to questions now. And we've got... people in the audience now, I'm going to open it up and say it's a free-for-all. So if you want to ask questions about the N3N, about the Growler, about Tammy Jo, about Claire, I'm sure there are some questions out there. So who do we got? First question. There's one in the corner over there.
Some of our UOs are qualified in private pilots, but we are not qualified as pilots in this airframe.
Okay.
Tammy, what was your call sign in the military?
Bonnie. I know, it's not very exciting, but I was glad I didn't earn an exciting one. my first instructor's call sign was Clyde, and so the schedulers saw my maiden name, which was Bonnell, and thought, So they put us on the schedule as Bonnie and Clyde and giggled like schoolgirls every time they called us to say our jet was ready. But that's it, Bonnie.
Thank you.
All right, other questions? Okay, we got some down here. Wait, she'll give you a mic. Oh, wait, we have one over here. Okay, we'll get to you. Hold on a second. Go ahead, over on this side.
Yeah, Tammy, during the incident, you had initial control issues. Did those continue with you to landing?
So the control issues, the snap roll that we did to 41 degrees, that was brought on by the explosion, and you know that wing kind of being stopping like it was a sea anchor. The other wing going so quickly, which gave it more lift, that gave us that snap roll, the pitch over. So we certainly were able to keep control of the aircraft. We did have a little roll problems turning left into that engine. We had to do that very carefully or wanted to overbank. But just, you know, we lost it. It severed hydraulic lines, fuel lines, things like that on that side. So there was some degradation of control, but mainly it was just the fact that we had so much damage and those pieces of cowling that were flailing in the wind at the wing of the root just made it a little, it was like flying through boulders rather than that slipstream that you're normally feeling.
Okay. Next, over here.
I actually have a question for Claire. I'm a 17-year-old student pilot. I'm about to really close to get my private. How many hours did you have when you just about, like, and how many hours do you have now?
So when I got my private pilot, I probably had around, like, 70 hours. I got very lucky that I grew up where I grew up, and so we had airplanes. I had airplanes at my disposal to kind of fly whenever I wanted. Right now I have just over 300 hours. So, yeah. And good luck.
Thank you so much.
All right. Anything else for any of the people up here? Okay. Well, I will say now, if there's no other questions, we have one other presentation to make. And I'll get a member of my staff. I see. Oh, there's Connie back there. Yeah, Connie is going to help out on this. And afterwards, by the way, if you haven't read her book, Nerves of Steel is the name of the book. She's just basically talked about the tip of the iceberg here. She's got some great stories. She's left some of the really bad stories out. I'll say that right now. Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate that. And she went through much more than she admits to right now in some of her her naval career. I'll be honest with you. I thought some of this stuff was inappropriate. You know, some of the things that happened to you. But I grew up in that world also. I was one of those fighter guys, and I knew some of the guys who said, no, somebody like that doesn't deserve to do what we do. You have obviously proved them wrong. I'm happy to say that. Oh, and we were talking about the combat exclusion also. The combat exclusion was in place basically the entire time that you were flying the United States Navy. And then they lifted it. I want to say that would have been probably 93, somewhere along in there. And now, you know, females, hey, they can go beyond the support role, which is what you were in, basically. And I found it interesting also, a sidelight, you know, carrier qual pilot, okay, you know, and an instructor in carrier quals, you know. Yet they didn't let you land at night. Is that right?
Right. If you weren't ship-based, then there was no need to put you through that qual zone.
Which, to me, I'm just going, huh? You got to be kidding me, you know. They wouldn't let her land, you know, at night on the ship. And I'm just going, huh? I didn't get that one. But now they're full up. Now they deploy full operational squadrons. They go to sea. Normal. They're just like everybody else out there. And I think it interesting that at the current time, or last week, I guess it was, President Biden nominated the newest CNO, if you all haven't seen that, Lisa Franchetti, Admiral, was just nominated. She hasn't been appointed yet, but she's going to be the highest-ranking naval officer, which I find rather interesting. And she's not a flyer, you know, what can I say? But nonetheless.
Then we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, we will. We'll have to wait and see. But what we have here, we have a volunteer who his call sign is Chaco, by the way. Yeah, well, guess why, you know. Okay. And so we've got some memorial chocks for you, and you can use them if you want. She flies a Malibu now, right? Okay, that's their airplane that they go around in. And if you want to use it on the Malibu, I'm sure it'll work. But it's got your name on one side of it. It's got an F-18 Hornet on the other side of it. He signed it on the bottom, and his standard is an A-4. His name is Dave Jackson. If you see him around here, we'll introduce you. But I just, you know, when I turned into a commander way back when, I had a commander's coin, and I always wanted people to remember, you know, who gave them that coin, just like I'd like you to remember who gave you this chalk. And so I just happened to have a little sticker that says United States Air Force on it. So Tammy Jo,
it will be my lucky chalk.
I say thank you very much for what you've done.